Blog Talk Radio.
Have you ever wondered why it's happening again?
Welcome to Mindshifters Radio with your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice, and his wife Jeannie. Michael and Jeannie share with you the wisdom of the ancient Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. They offer tools and support 5 days a week. They will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love. In Aramaic, Rachma. Michael is the author of Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information on Michael and Jeannie, please visit www.whyagain.com. And now your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice.
To the brightness within you and the truth that is rooted within me.
Hi, and welcome to Mindshifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm your co-host, Jeannie Rice. We also have Dr. Tim Hayes and Del Hoffman, along with Michael Rice. Today is Friday, Aramaic Friday, June the 27th, 2014. Our call-in number is 646-200-4169, and press 1, and that puts you in queue to talk to us. And we would love to hear your comments and your questions, because that makes this your show. Welcome, Michael.
Hey, dear heart. Nice to hear your voice. You sound like you're rocking along. And
I mean,
by the way, you're loud
Gideon,
and clear.
It's a little bit noisy here.
Well, actually, you're coming through loud and clear. There's no noise in the background, so. Fabulous. Well, we're just delighted. We're honored that everybody's here to share with us. It is our privilege to get this time, to spend this time in learning, teaching, understanding this awesome ancient tool that we've been given called forgiveness. And, of course, the focal point of everything that we're doing is that of removing, that is, forgiving, everything that never belonged within our experience. Hold a newborn child, you know it belonged. Anything unlike that newborn experience is a fit subject for forgiveness. And it's Aramaic Fridays, and we've got Dale with us today. But before I introduce Dale, we have a new arrival at Heartland. Actually, Jim, I think, arrived Saturday. So, been here since Saturday, and some of you may know Jim Farmer. He's an early adopter of Heartland. Actually, he was here for an intensive the first summer we opened, and was back several times over the years. Spent a year here back about, 10, 12 years ago, and is back again. So, Jim, welcome.
Well, thank you, Michael. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Okay. Yes, it was the year I spent here was 1997 and 98, half of each. And I'm so excited to be back. Of course, the work has been wonderful for me. It's changed my whole view of how I see the world. And I recently, it wasn't the reason I came out here, but it's a side benefit. I recently had experienced some severe back pain with spinal stenosis, and it was very limiting. Was bedridden back home for a few months, actually. In fact, I missed my oldest grandson's wedding, which was really not a good thing. But anyway, I just wasn't able to travel back in early April when he got married. But I arrived here on the 14th of June, and my goal was to heal my back. I mean, I've been walking with a cane since I got back up on my feet. So I've been doing a lot of worksheets, and Michael shared with me that, you shared with me, Michael, that the source of back pain is very often uncontrolled rage. And I thought, rage. Yeah, that could be me. So I started doing worksheets on back pain and getting back into the emotion that I felt when I stuffed the back pain, which was something that I learned years ago that really helpful in doing a worksheet as opposed to it just being a mental exercise. It's really helpful if we get into the energy or the emotion that we felt when we stuffed that pain or rage in the first place, when our thoughts helped us do that. So I had one particular worksheet. It was that third of five that day that I just knew I had moved a chunk of energy. I could just feel it. It was emotion come up for me pretty strongly during that worksheet. And when I completed it, I just felt that I had removed a chunk of negative energy. And so a little while later that same day, I was walking down to the Heart Center from the treehouse where I live, and Mick and Judy were walking behind me, probably 100 feet behind me, and Mick turned to Judy and he said, "Judy, look at Jim, he's walking straight up and he's carrying his cane." And I walked for probably 100 feet or so, or a little bit longer, without the use of the cane, and I was walking straight. Prior to that, stenosis kind of tends to have you lean forward, and that's why you'll see so many people out in the supermarkets, older people, bend forward, is because that's the position that helps relieve some of the pain. So I felt myself walking straight.
But we know it's not stenosis that makes us lean forward, right? Because in that 100-foot walk, you obviously didn't disappear stenosis.
I'm sorry, Michael. My phone broke up a little bit. Could you repeat that?
I was just offering the thought that, you know, the culture says stenosis causes us to fold over like that.
Oh, yes. Yep, for sure. Then today, I'm coming up to the office here, and I'm halfway up the office, and Judy is walking next to me. Halfway up to the office, I realize I forgot my cane. And I was walking straight up and didn't even realize it. So it's just phenomenal. And I expect I'm going to be here for at least 2 months and perhaps longer. I expect before the 2 months is up, I'll be walking straight and not even thinking about my back. Anyway, Michael, I thank you, and Jeannie, I thank you. And the work is just phenomenal. I can't thank you guys enough.
Jim, maybe you'd share, as you were walking up, as you shared with me this morning, as you were walking up the hill, got halfway here and had no back pain and no realization that you didn't have your cane, because this just, you know, really opens the space for us to realize what goes on, that once you realized you weren't walking with your cane, what did you share with me happened?
I left an important part out. When I realized that I had forgotten my cane, a few steps later, I started to walk slower, found myself bending forward a little bit, and the further I got along as I approached the office, the pain got worse and I bent forward more. And so I asked myself the question about an hour later. It occurred to me, I said, gee, I wonder what would have happened if I had not remembered that I had forgotten my cane. And my thought that bubbled up for me was that, you know what, I bet if I had not remembered I had forgotten my cane, I would have walked straight up without pain all the way up to the office. So it was really super strong evidence that it was the thought that I had forgotten my pain. I forgot my cane, pardon me. That was a Freudian slip. I had forgotten both, the cane and the pain. I think I would not have experienced pain, and I would have walked upright. And it was just that thought that brought me back to the place of remembering, oh, yeah, that's right. I'm supposed to be in pain. I'm supposed to be bent over. Wrong, Jim. That's not the way the Creator intended for me to walk on this planet, or any of us for that matter. So anyway, it was it's been a great 2 weeks and a very interesting day today for sure. And again, Michael, blessings and thank you so much. I appreciate all the work you've done and the way you've been in support of myself and my family all of these years. Since 1989 was the first year I came here. Anyway, I don't want to take up any more of your radio time, but thanks for inviting me on. I appreciate it.
Actually, Jim, you're not taking up time. You're contributing time, and we appreciate that because it opens a space, and maybe this can be the kickoff for where we're going to head with the Aramaic with Dale today. I don't know if Dale has anything particular in mind, but you remind me of a piece of research. It was done by a medical doctor, a guy named Braun, and he took a woman who had diabetes and multiple personality disorder into the laboratory. He has all of her stats. She's got diabetes. If you give her insulin, or you don't give her insulin, she's likely going to go into a coma and die. And then, having her all hooked up and measuring all her stats, they induce a personality shift. In other words, they do something that gets her to shift out of her normal persona into a different persona. Usually people who have multiple personality, they call it a disorder, but usually people who have that, it's an adaptation to tremendous amounts of abuse and strain and stress. And so the true multiple has different energy packets, different mind energy packets, different identities that resonate and rule how they feel, how they think, and their physiology. And so they induce a personality shift in this woman who's got full-blown diabetes, and all of a sudden there is no trace of diabetes whatsoever. I mean, literally, in that instant, there's no trace of diabetes. If they gave her insulin, it could kill her. And, you know, it really, if you go to the opening words in the book of John in the Aramaic, where it says, in the beginning was the mind energy, and the mind energy became flesh, you realize that what we were being told is how this world operates. And, of course, when you forget your persona that's supposed to be doubled over in pain, and, oh, I have a physical problem called stenosis, therefore I must stay bent. When you forget that and a different energy runs in the system, having let go of some of that unconscious rage, then that frequency is governing your structure, and in that instant is what creates your physiology. And my offering would be that the minute you remember that you don't have my cane and I'm supposed to be, that different mind energy comes in, and literally the instant the mind energy shifts, the physiology shifts, because there is no such thing as a physical body. There's only energy, and the energy that we engage in determines what our physiology does. Our culture teaches us that we're supposed to get old, so what do people do? Their physiology reflects aging. Is it possible all of that's a lie? And I'd like to use that as a segue into introducing Dale Allen Hoffman, who's our resident. We're blessed to have our resident Aramaic scholar, scholar in practicum, one who is a practical scholar, not an ivory tower scholar. And his website is daleallenhoffman.com. I just heard from somebody the other day. Dale and I had done a workshop in Asheville, North Carolina, a couple of weeks ago, and one of the people was there, bought a package of Dale's CDs and DVDs, and texted me a couple of days ago saying how impactful it was being in her life. So if you're interested in getting more of Dale's information, you can get it from his website. And Dale, welcome to the show. How do you be, sir?
I'm phenomenal. And it's been great. It's been a great opening to the show. I've been sort of a fly on the wall, which is nice. Not that I want to be a fly per se, but, you know, you spoke of the ape, and I spoke a lot of, well, I believe you said persona, which would be ape in Aramaic. Ape is such an interesting word because ape, it's a funny thing because it's three letters. It's actually, technically, if you look at it on the page, it looks like it should be pronounced apa, which is an interesting thing. It's almost the same as the word Abba, which is that word for our father. But instead of a bait, the second letter in there is a pay. And what's interesting about the letter pay, which is the puh sound in Aramaic, pay, like a P sound, pay is a letter that means to puff up or to puff up in the mouth, actually, is what it means, or to just basically yak from the mouth, to gush from the mouth, which is interesting how the word ape, which is the word of persona, which means mask or veil or hypocrite, all those words are the same word ape. It literally means to puff up at the mouth. And, you know, we live so much of our life from the persona or in the persona, the false self, what you would call the digital self or the non-being self. And it's an amazing thing for me to be out on the road and to meet people. I just spent a week and a half in Florida to be able to help them realize that there is that false self. And when you sort of help them disengage that for even just a few microseconds, just the look in their eye makes everything worth it. It's just amazing to see the spark. That happens in the forgiveness process. It happens a lot of times. You don't know when it's going to happen. It just kind of comes up behind you, very feminine, wraps her arms around you. But it's really cool to see that. I saw that quite a bit over the last couple of weeks. The people going, oh, hold on, not realizing that they've been living from the false self. It's just a beautiful moment to see it open.
Well, and my offering would be that false self is the residence and the root of every disease process that we will ever experience, and that's why forgiveness is so powerful. We'll go back to Yeshua, and he says, in order for you to live, you've got to die. And what does that mean? If you don't understand, there's that false self. You know, you live by dying, that makes no sense. But when that puffed up self that comes out of the mouth is forgiven, when we forgive that content that makes up that puffed up self, then what's left is what the Creator created, and it is awesome perfection. And of course, the only task we have is that of removing everything from 1,000 generations that never belonged in this false self, in this puffed up self, in order to function as the truth of who we are, the awesome active presence of love. So that's an awesome explanation that just, you know, fleshes out everything that Jim was just saying. That's awesome.
And you know, when that happens, that in that forgiveness moment, or even just one of the things that I was explaining the other day in I think it was in Fort Pierce, Florida, where I was saying that kind of like you, a good example is like when your child enters into the teenage years. And I can't remember who said it. I think it was Larry Dossey. Somebody said that he put his daughter to bed at the age of 11 and didn't see her again until she graduated college. It's like this interesting thing. And we look at them and think, oh, look at what they are going through. Look at them. They're having all these problems, them, pointing at the child. When I was speaking the other day about how, you know, we were having a lot of difficulties with our daughter Lucinda, who's now 15. A couple of years ago, everything was happening, you know, hormones raging, all different kinds of social things going on. And I was just watching her one day, and I just saw her in a different light. I just let down the mask for just a microsecond, and I just literally burst into tears because it was like, look at all this that we as parents project back onto the children, which is the very thing that when we were her age, when we were Lucinda's age, we're like, oh, I'll never do that, you know. And, of course, you know, you nail it in there, cement it in, and then here we are, and those words are flying out from my own mask. And it's like in the beginning, they're flying out of your mouth, and you don't even realize, you're just completely unconscious. But the more and more you awaken, you start noticing them as they're leaving, and then you catch them before they leave, and then ultimately they're not there to resonate out anymore at all. You just don't even feel it anymore. But what an interesting process. You think you got a lot of stuff handled, and then you've got a teenager who's going through all this stuff. Everything's just upside down. They're trying to figure out who they are, where they fit in the world and everything. And then all of a sudden, all that stuff you haven't processed in your own heart, all of a sudden here it comes. And wow, it's an awesome process. And yet, still, even after all these years of work, and just constantly peeling back layers and burning away the bushel baskets within myself, obviously there's still more. And like you say, you've only got, you know, all of the previous generations to move through. So it all happens in this moment, though.
That is an awesome process. And when you realize, you know, one day Jeannie was, I had her computer down at the Heart Center. We were talking about 100 generations, 1,000 generations back. And that the Aramaic language being a genetic language, when they said the sins of the fathers will be passed again to 3 and 4 generations of those who hate me, I mean, that's such an awesome piece of information. And I can remember being told, you know, the sins of the fathers and wondering why I get punished for what my father did or his father, and man, realizing that the Aramaic is a genetic language, it had nothing to do with the Creator punishing anybody. They were just telling us how genetics work, that the frequencies, the energies that were put in, are going to move from generation to generation until somebody chooses to remove them if they're not serving the structure. And that Jeannie had her computer and did the math, and, you know, this was several years ago, so my number may not be accurate, but at this level, it doesn't matter how accurate it is. But it was something like 5,845 to the 90th power. So 5,845 with 90 zeros behind it is how many people you and I have in 100 generations of our bloodline. And so we can get a real sense of why the work isn't over in a day, a week, a month, a year, 10 years, 20 years, 50 years. It's a lifetime of work. And to awaken, you know, the idea of being born again hasn't got something to do with saying magic words. The idea of being born again is literal and real. If we're stuck in this persona, if we've given up the truth of who we are, and we're stuck in this persona, and we think that's who we are, then we're asleep. And we are bound by the servants, literally, as Yeshua said 2,000 years ago, by the servants at our own household. Our own temple, this body-mind unit, is meant to serve us. And yet, if the dynamics that have been stored from 1,000 generations are resonated into activity, the average person just succumbs to whatever that frequency is and believes that what it's experiencing, what's showing up in its mind, which is all totally internal, is actually happening out there in the world and it's somebody else's fault. And that's just such a deep state of sleep. And, you know, to me, one of the most important insights of this work in the last 45 years has been the definition of denial. That denial is when I think or speak as though something outside of me is causing something to happen inside of me. So somebody says, you know, well, I just can't hang around here. I can't stand you because there's something wrong with you. That person is so asleep in their own unconsciousness, they have no idea that what they can't stand is inside of themselves, that it's part of their own persona. And they couldn't experience if it weren't in there. And there are people who will speak in language as though it's actually about somebody else, what they're feeling, what they're experiencing, the reason that they have to leave, they have to run away, they won't speak up, they won't. The reason is because of what you did or what you said. And that state of sleep is what destroys generations and generations, causes all suffering, pain, trauma, disease. And when we wake up, when we're quite literally born again, awakening to the truth of who we are and that we are not this persona. And that's the second half of that quote, the sins of the fathers, and sin being an archery term, being off the mark, the energies that are off the mark from all the generations will be passed on to succeeding generations. And then such a powerful, and I'd love to hear you address this, Dale, a powerful phrase when we understand what it means. The Creator saying this and saying, yea, of those who hate me. And that word hate there, not being as in a love-hate relationship, but those who are separated from me, that is, who cannot bring forward the active presence of love, can't awaken, can't be born again, can't step into the true self because they don't have the processing power to move out those generational patterns. So those who are separated from the active presence of love can't clean up their own multi-generational database, and they're stuck and lost in it. That simple little phrase that sounded like a threat, the sins of the fathers will be, is just such an awesome piece of information, as is everything else when you've got the Aramaic understanding of it. Any thoughts around that?
Well, you know, when you say that word hate, there's really only one clear word that was translated as hate in Aramaic, and it's the word snay. And that's exactly what snay means. Snay means to either uproot something or to cut something in half, like to divide it, to separate something. And that's exactly, that's almost actually the meaning of what the word blasphemy means. Blasphemy means to cut something away from its source, again, to uproot something. And, of course, that also, it's the meaning of so many words in Yeshua's language. Satana, what we know of as Satan, is a being divided against itself. Akil Kartza, which was the one, the tempter, the accuser, the resister, is, again, it's the inner critic. It's us fighting against us. Yeshua was constantly speaking. It's kind of like the way I say it. It's almost like he was speaking in a negative connotation to put light on the places where we cut ourselves in half. Like, as an example, I talk about how, you know, you're standing next to a mountain and you see a rock in the mountain and you're looking at the mountain and it's a mountain, and all of a sudden you pull the rock away and you stand 10 feet away. Now you say, look, I have a rock, and that's a mountain over there. But yet the rock is the mountain, and that's what snay means. It means to cut. It's that false self, and you cut it away, and it looks like you're cutting the person in front of you away from source. You're saying, oh, no, I hate them because they're not living it, or I hate them because blah, blah, blah. And it's all the projection. When we cut apart ourselves inside of ourselves figuratively, of course, that all projects, and we project it onto our image of the person standing in front of us. And we look at them and we say, well, I hate them because, you know, it's an interesting thought, because just in the last year, I've been very consciously looking at some of the people in my life that, even people that I felt are very spiritually, you know, whatever, awake in one way or another, and I started paying a lot of attention of listening to certain people's languages. And one of the things I heard a lot from one particular person, I kept hearing hate. I hate this person's music. I hate that one's music. I hate this. I hate that. And I went, wow. I mean, that's a really interesting, and I, you know, I, it wasn't a confrontation. It was, I said, that's a really interesting way. I'm surprised, you know, it's been there the whole time for years since I've known them, but I had never woken, you know, awakened to the thought of the word hate. And I was like, that's just an interesting way to live. You know, maybe you could find a different word, or go in and find what is it, rather than sort of re-script the words that you're saying, working from the outside in. You know, look at other possibilities of words you can use, and simultaneously go in and find what it is inside of you that keeps pulling you back to that hate. Because in Aramaic, snay literally means to cut something, to uproot, rip something away from its source, to divide it, to cut it, which again, along with all those other words, it's also the word for doubt, which is interesting. Well, it's not the word for doubt. The word for doubt is tetplug, which means to cut something in half, to divide something and say, this is not that. And that's what doubt means. So when you hear do not doubt, it means do not divide, which would be the same, you know, also with a different word, do not hate. Do not cut yourself from source. Keep yourself connected. Keep yourself plugged in. And it's interesting that all of those, every single solitary phrase that I can think of where Yeshua spoke of do not divide, keep yourself single, every single solitary one of those phrases in Aramaic or words were mistranslated. Every single one, not a single one, is still translated as to cut something from its source. They all ended up being translated into things like bushel baskets, Satan as a person, an accuser, a resister, a tempter, a devil, a demon, all of those words, ape, the mask, doubt, not one of those is translated in modern times after all the mistranslations with the word divide or cut something away from its source. I find that so intriguing. And it's right there at the root of every single one of those words. He was constantly saying, look, we're talking about one singular unity of being. We're talking about a life that is not separate from our perception, but rather, you know, the way I phrase it lately, I tell people, when you look in the mirror, we have to let go of that thought that thinks that somehow what we see in the reflection is separate from that which is observing it. Because we sort of live our life through the reflection, which is the mask, which is what's cut from the source. And it's not real. It's only real in that we're perceiving it, but we're not separate from that. And it's amazing to me that all of those phrases, when you take them back, all those things that meant to cut something away from truth, and to almost, you know, it's that digital word. Again, it's you take small samples of something rather than a pure sine wave, all of a sudden it looks like the sine wave, it looks like the real experience, but it's not. It's a carbon copy. And all of those words that had those meanings were mistranslated. Maybe just they didn't understand. I don't know that in those cases all of it was intentional, but it's amazing that I don't know that we really could have comprehended a lot of what he said until psychology progressed to a certain point, and even quantum theory progressed to a certain point, because for the longest time it was just locked in this theology for well over 1,500 years, and we're just now being able to dig into the nuance of a lot of what Yeshua was saying, and even his own disciples in a lot of cases didn't have a clue what he was saying, so who knows, but it's just intriguing to me how I notice those ways that I, as an example, have an experience in my life, and it doesn't feel good. So what I do is, what we sort of are programmed to do, especially here in the West, we look at the experience, and it's like, oh, well, I don't like this experience. And then, of course, what becomes obvious to you is that you don't like what you're seeing in your life, and then what begins reflecting back is things that you don't like, and then you begin that vicious cycle. And I even catch myself today, after all these years of doing the forgiveness process, realizing there's still another layer, there's another layer, there's another layer, there's another layer. And the thing that's beautiful about it is that recognizing that is that I'm coming from a place of empowerment. Rather than that false helplessness that I felt for so many years, I don't look at it and go, oh my God, one more layer. I don't feel it at all. I go, wow, this is an opportunity for me to wake up even more so and to remove even one more bushel basket. And that's a place of empowerment for me. It's interesting when people mention, you know, in a lot of cases, they're like, oh my God, so you're saying we just have to keep doing forgiveness over and over and over again. Oh my God, it sounds so exhausting. I'm like, yes, and your life is working so well now, isn't it? Beautiful.
Well, it ties back in. You know, there's a story that we tell at a key point in the forgiveness process around the canceling of a goal, and that is the story of the rose and the butterfly. For those who perhaps haven't heard it, imagine we have a rose and a butterfly. They meet, they fall in love. We give them each an ego. They meet, they fall in love. They have this wonderful time together, and then one day the butterfly up and flies away. The rose, knowing that the love of the butterfly is the most important thing in its life, uproots itself to give chase. And what happens to that rose? Obviously, it dies. Why does it die? It dies because it made something more important than being connected to its source. We all started out exactly the same way. Hold a newborn child. We all started out as this awesome, active presence of love. And then the world started to teach us that something was more important. And we started to take on the ability to form goals that were not in harmony with the true self. And by doing so, we separated from the true self. And there's only one mistake in all the world, and that is I made something more important than being connected to my source, which is love. And when I cancel that goal, then and only then can I return to that source, because it is that goal with all of its attendant energies that keeps me away from awareness of my connectedness. And so that whole process is one of forgiveness that returns us to the connectedness, the importance of living in that absolutely fabulous state of connection to love. And in order for you to live, you've got to die. You've got to die to the old self, and all its goals and all its garbage has to go. And that's the process of reawakening to the truth of who we are. And we are the inheritors of 1,000 generations of goals, the desire for this, that, and the next thing. And they're all the things that keep us from our true essence, our true being, and the truth of who we are. And those energies, when we put them into our physiology, are what destroy our physiology. So the genius of it, and of course, when you marvel, Dale, at how every word that represents that true problem has been mistranslated, it makes perfect sense. You know, Yeshua says you've got to have the eyes to see and the ears to hear. You've got to have the brain cells. People could not, no one can translate the words for something they haven't experienced. People who are sitting in the ivory tower going, this word means this, and that word means that, and that word means that, cannot possibly, if they haven't done the experience, translate something they have no brain cells for. You got to have those eyes to see and those ears to hear. And, you know, it means you have to actually step into the process and do your work and realize that separation, pardon me, and remove that which separates, the act of forgiveness. Otherwise, no translation is possible. To me, that's one of the things, Dale, that causes me to refer to you as a practical scholar, because you're in the fray. You're in the process of doing your work. You're not sitting up in some ivory tower looking through a magnifying glass at letters going, I wonder if we could change the meaning of that word to something else. I wonder how the Greeks, I wonder if... But you're living it, and you're in the fray.
That's a good voice. That's a great voice.
And you have to go through the fray to have the brain cells to know what it's about. And, you know, you look at the people who created the doctrines, the dogmas based in rage, and they're ragers. The doctrines based in fear, and they're fear. They have no connection to love, no connection to their source. Oh, they have this thing called approval, and they approve, and they're nice, and they pat the people on the head who do everything that they want, but they don't have the direct experience of being free from the separated self in the full-blown experience of the active presence, because they refuse to face what's in them and clean it out. So they make up all kinds of doctrines and dogmas, but doctrine and dogma will never get you the direct physiological experience of the presence of the love of God. It will never go there. But when we stop, we apply the tools, we get a taste, and then what else is there to do but to go after that?
Yeah, I've had a couple of places writing that my book that I actually went in and I started feeling like a little bit of I felt like a little bit of like a hostility of judgment kind of thing about people that, you know, I felt weren't getting it kind of a thing. And it was funny because I kind of pulled myself back in the writing and I went, well, that's an interesting thing. I was pointing, you know, and I started realizing, you know, how can I communicate in such a way in the writing of the book that is less about, you know, me pointing a finger, and it was more about, you know, living it. And that's exactly what I did. I sort of brought it all back to, look, you know, I think the best thing, I think we talked about it last week, or maybe it was the week before. I think it was last week, and I was talking about how it talks about in the Kabbalist Enlightenment about chocolate. We can talk about chocolate. We can spend 20 pages on chocolate. I can do a 4-hour documentary all about chocolate, a 4-part series that plays four nights in a row. And let's just say, you know, unfortunately, you know, 1,000 years down the road, let's say there's no such thing as chocolate. How do I actually put that into a documentary? So I make this amazing documentary all about chocolate 1,000 years from now, talking all about the taste of chocolate. And yet I can't imagine anything that I could possibly say ever that would be able to put the taste of chocolate across on the page. And it's the one thing that I'm really, really, really so incredibly focused on in my work is I'm interested, you know, like as an example, after I left Heartland in 95, my first sort of full-blown experience working with the Aramaic experientially, I went and bought every single solitary book that Rocco Errico had written, and everything I could get my hands on, at least from George Lamza, and I read them all, and I was like, well, that's nice. What's next? So then I found Neil Douglas Klotz, and I got, you know, really deep into everything he said. I went, okay, what's next? So then I started getting into all these scholarly books, and then I started getting in, going to these different symposiums and biblical language things, and I started getting into other languages, and I kept going, what's next? What's next? And it was just this constant pursuit for something else. And it was like several years down the road when I went, hey, Dale, guess what? All of the what's next is keeping you from actually trying to put any of this into practice and actually living it. There's always some sort of outside thing. And the outside thing is, again, looking for something outside is, yet again, it's that division that I was speaking of. It's somehow thinking that there's something outside of me that's going to somehow complete somehow that one key or that one piece of information is going to complete the whole thing. And I realized that, you know, I wasn't really supposed to be in the room that's just obsessed with gathering information in their head. And I'm not saying there's not an importance in that. Yeah, of course there's an importance in it. But if the rubber doesn't hit the road, the map is going to do you absolutely no good whatsoever. The map is not the terrain. It's not the territory. You've got to actually either go on the journey or, you know, shut your mouth and just talk about maps the rest of your life, you know. And that's the thing for me. I'm interested in map makers. I'm interested in the people that are, you know, putting certain things down on paper. But I'm not all that interested anymore because I realize that so much of it is just this circle that comes right back upon itself. And it gets deep in all of the – it's not even deep, really. It just gets confused in all of this rhetoric and all of these things of does it mean this or does it mean that. And it's like, look, if you're not willing to put it into practice, bless your heart, thank you for your work, but I really don't really have a deep care for what you have to say anymore. It's really time. The young kids are coming up to me going, look, man, we don't want the games anymore. Just hit us, you know, hit us with it directly. Tell us exactly what's on the page. Tell us what we do know, what we don't know, and how do we actually put it into practice, and that's it. You know, they don't care about the theology. They don't care about all of the ideologies. They literally do not care. They'll literally put their hand up sometimes and say, don't care, don't want to hear about it, which is funny because I don't talk about it much either. I might, you know, if somebody – I feel a lot like in when Yeshua was asked about the greatest of the, you know, the ordinances on a human sense of what we must live up to, and it didn't answer with that. He answered with the greatest of the orita, which is that law of light that lives through us. That's kind of what I see myself out there doing. People are coming to me with whatever their framework is of who they think I am or not sure or whatever it may be. I'm a Bible banger. I'm a Bible hater. Who knows what they're thinking? And if there's any challenge in what I'm doing, it's exposing those places where we divide ourselves and realize that if we're not living it and putting it into practice, then it doesn't matter how much we understand about it. You can go and memorize A Course in Miracles from front to back. You can memorize the Bible from front to back. And memorizing information has absolutely nothing to do with actualization and realization in your heart. And that's why I constantly say it. I probably say it in every show, and I'll say it again. I'm just so thrilled to be on the team of what comes out of Heartland and, you know, starting with why again. And it's the one thing in my book. In the back, there's a recommended resources. Hopefully it'll end up there after publishers get a hold of it. The number one thing right on that list is, why is this happening to me again, the book and the DVD? It's like, you got to get it, you got to get it. Because if you don't understand that base of forgiveness and how the system works, you really don't understand anything, because the information, that mask, will never take the place of the true direct experience, ever.
Well, it's interesting that you brought up that first law, because that's exactly where my mind was and where I was going to head next as you spoke what you spoke. And when you listen to the directive that Yeshua has given, you know, he's giving them all this understanding and the use of the tools, and they say to him, what's most important in all that you're teaching us? And what does he say? Go hold the newborn child. Well, no, that's not actually what he said. But in essence, that was it. Hold the newborn child, and you know what human life is. Have a human life. Now you have the experience that all the doctrine and the dogma is pointing to. But all the doctrine and the dogma will never give you that experience. What will give you the experience? What did he say? Here's how it works. You maintain a condition in your mind. You keep a gateway called Rachma open when you think of the Creator, when you think of neighbor, and that's how you maintain self. First order of business, maintain the truth of who you are, this awesome presence of love, rather than being separated from who you are, the source of your true being and the self that is true. And then he gives, you know, to me what is, I can remember the first time I had the insight of what this next phrase meant, and it was so exciting to me that I got on the phone and I called 200 years of religious experience, 200 years of religious life. I called everybody that I knew, a priest, a minister, a rabbi, a nun, anybody and everybody that I knew had an interest in the law, and I said, do you realize what this means? Have you ever looked at this? And everybody went, okay, so what? And it was interesting, the weekend, we were teaching laws of living here at Heartland, and there was a minister here who was speaking at a church about an hour away from here. And we went to the service, and that particular topic was the topic that this preacher preached on, was the first law. And they had a Bible, and I don't remember which Bible it was that they had. And the whole essence of maintaining that condition of love was just totally lost on it. And the importance of the next phrase when Yeshua gave them the answer, here's what you must do, maintain your human life, maintain love through Rachma, when you think of the Creator, when you think of neighbor. And then he says, for upon this, that is, upon this condition in your mind, the active presence of love, hangs the law and all of its prophets. In other words, if you walk up to a Bible with a mind based in hostility or fear, and you don't have a mind of love, you are going to make tear that book to shreds and destroy people's lives with it. You look at how many people have been destroyed through the fear of God. You know, they talk about this great and wonderful dogma and doctrine, but they've never had the direct experience of the active presence of the love of God in their physiology because you can't get it out of a fear-based teaching. And for me, that was such an exciting insight, and these 200 years of religious experience that I talked to, it's like, it didn't mean anything. It's like, so what? What do you have to have first? What's the protocol for living and understanding what this thing called a human life is and understanding the law and the prophets? You've got to have a human life first. You've got to have the active presence of love in you. If you don't have it, you can't understand it. And you look at how many have made up stories, and I mean, what do we have? We've got 41,000 sects of Christianity, 41,000 people who, a great many of them, if you look around at what much of the world is doing with so-called Christianity, in their hostility and fear, reading the book and going, here's what it means, here's, no, we've got it, no, it's this, it's this, it's this. And my offering is, the best truth you can find is, don't believe a word I've got to say. Here's some tools. Go have the experience. Don't believe a word I've got to say. Here's some tools. Go have an experience. Go create the active, the remembering and the presence of the action of love in your physiology. Then you can start to talk about the law and the prophets. Until then, if you haven't had that experience, forget it, because you're wasting your time.
Yeah, it's the law that where we talk so much, people talk till they're blue in the face about some sort of outside law that we have to live within, like these fences, when it's funny how everything that Yeshua spoke of was about tearing down those fences and understanding that there's already an innate law, a guidance system, you know, that law of light, the Arita, that lives through us when we just allow ourselves to get out of the way. And it's in all of his teachings. It's in the Beatitudes. It's in Tuve Hun. It's over and over in all these different places saying, look, this is already in your system. If you would just let go of all those bushel baskets that you pile on top of that natural light, it will live you, and it's a guidance system that you don't have to second guess. The terrain is embedded in the journey itself, but it's not going to happen, and it's not going to work when we're laying our own, you know, self-made human map on top of the map of truth. And the map of truth is not something that you can necessarily look and see in the physical realm. It lives through us when we're open, and it happens in those moments in still point. It happens holding the baby. It happens after the forgiveness process when you feel that wide open. You just feel it. You feel that light. You feel that essence. That's who we are. And, man, everybody's constantly looking for something out there. It's not out there.
And how do you tell if the roadmap that's being followed is made out of the non-being belief systems or is made out of truth? Is there a word based in hostility or fear in it?
Mm.
You know, you listen to how many people, I mean, there are people who will actually stand up and quote as though it's in the scripture, the beginning of wisdom is the fear of God. And I've talked to so many preachers who said, that's not the word, it's not fear. They go, oh, no, that's, we know that. It's like, well, why are you still using the word fear? Yeshua says, the power of life and death is in your word. Why are you still using the word fear? Oh, well, you know. Not
yeah.
much of an explanation for that, but the minute that fear comes into the game, we know we're separated from the active presence of love because there's no love in fear. There's no fear in love.
Because that's what fear means. It's the ultimate separation.
The
it's like, hello.
Exactly. Cut off from. Cut off from. So we get so many of it, they start out and pound that terror into a child and that self-deprecation and that self-destruction, and they do it supposedly in the name of God. And it's like, wake up, folks. Yeshua says you've got to look into your errors in thought and the errors of your society. Take him at his word. Actually believe what the man said and start looking for those errors. If it isn't about love, it isn't about the Creator. Well, what about all those stories? You know, go for all those stories. Men have told a lot of stories. But if it's not about love, it's not about the Creator. It just isn't there.
Wow.
Let's say hello to Dr. Tim and see if he has any thoughts to share with us on this topic.
Well, I'm thoroughly enjoying the topic. I can tell you that. I don't know if I have anything of value to share. I was just thinking about the past week and the layers of denial and how effective and efficient the system is. And several times this week I have relived in my mind how totally clear and calm and sure I was of myself at lunch on Tuesday talking to Mark. And he said, oh, I bet you must have had a lot of anger at that person who did that. And I said, no, not really aware of any anger at all. I do have that sick feeling in the pit of my stomach, though, and went on and on and on. And later that night when I did a worksheet process, I have had the vivid memory of experience pop in of hearing my mother many times over the past 55 years tell how she had to try to help my sister whose fingertip had been cut off, and at the same time keep her two sons from hurting their other sister because they were so angry at her for what she had done. And I just marvel at the efficiency of the denial and suppression mechanism.
Even it is amazing, isn't it?
Even at this late stage of the game.
Yeah.
Of course, I think that's kind of grandiose for me to say I'm in the late stage of the game, but
I think you're doing some pretty awesome work, my friend. Doing some pretty awesome work. But perhaps you could share, just for people in our audience, and Dale probably wasn't on the show a few days ago when you shared that, so maybe you could just kind of briefly run through it again. It was such a powerful story, and people will not be wondering, well, gee, what's he talking about, the finger and the...
Well, I've had a lifelong issue of, even though I've liked action movies and things, if there was any kind of a mutilation in the torture scene or whatever, I would feel physically sick to my stomach and leave the theater or turn the movie off. And I was sitting with a friend on Tuesday, and he said, why do you think that is? And I said, really, I have no idea. It's just something that's always been there. And it's part of why I know that with certain patients, it's not good for me to work with them, because if I haven't worked through my issues on that, then I can't help them. And he asked again, he said, so what do you think the roots of that were? And I started to say, I have no idea, and couldn't even get the phrase out, and I had this vivid image in my mind of when I was maybe at the most 5 years old, and my younger sister had the tip of her finger cut off, because there was a Dutch door where the top opened separately from the bottom, and there's this very, very fine tolerance in between, and my other younger sister slammed the door on her finger, and it literally had the end of her finger laying on the floor, completely severed from her hand. And I thought, wow, there's a whole bit of denial and suppression. Because he asked me, and I said, it was the second or third time he'd asked me, what do you think is the source of that? And in 55 years, I've never made the connection between seeing my sister's finger get mutilated or cut off from her hand with all of these things in movies that were so upsetting to me. And then he said, wow, I bet you had some real anger for the sister who slammed the door on the other sister's finger. And I said, oh, no, not really aware of that at all. I do have that, but it's interesting, though, how that's connected to the nausea, and I'll have to do some worksheets on that. And then, as I reported later in that night when I did the worksheet on feeling nauseous and like I can't handle this, I'm going to be sick, cancel the goal, ask to be shown the hidden part of my mind, and what I got shown was the memory of my mom describing this to people, saying how angry my brother and I were at my second sister for having done this. Wow. It's a happy ending to the story. My mom put the fingertip on ice and put ice on my sister's finger and called the doctor and had the finger sewed back on. And today, she's as whole as can be. And if you look at her, there's just a couple creases in her little fingernail. But what I downloaded from that incident, and the way it's been directly influencing my experience in life for the past 55 years, is just boggling my mind right now. It just absolutely amazes me.
To me, what's even more amazing, Dr. Tim, is 2,000 years ago, an understanding of exactly what you're describing, that unconscious impact affecting perception and behavior. And, you know, what you've been talking about is your perception around mutilation and your behavior, that 2,000 years ago, in the Aramaic, they had that understanding built into the language. And it's just like, it is mind-boggling to recognize they had that depth of understanding. It's just amazing. And Jeannie just texted me and said Magda has her hand up with a question, and we've just got a couple of minutes, so let's see if we get Magda's question in.
She actually has dropped her hand, so Magda, if you're still on there, hit one again.
Otherwise, Dale, we've got just a minute or so left. Do you have anything to add to that idea of the Aramaic having the understanding of those unconscious dynamics? Because to me, that's like so huge.
You know, what's really sort of up in my heart right now is that there's just so many people that I've seen that are, you know, they're just label themselves experts or, you know, like they've got the whole thing figured out. I'm so thankful, and I have such a great gratitude for being able to just let go and let go, that knowing that there's always something more to know. And that, again, it's not about information. It's about transformation. It's about realizing that if we're not bringing it into our heart and living it, then what we think we know in terms of the information really doesn't matter, because everything Yeshua said was about the magic, and that true magic of life, the true awakening, is something that you can't find in this world, something that's not in time and space. It's not letters on the page. You know, it's not a piece of information that you didn't discover yet. It's something that happens in the journey itself. And I'm just feeling such a great gratitude. This has been a really profound show in so many ways from beginning to end.
And we are out of time.
And we're going to have to close the show. Thank you, Dale. We'll look forward to talking with you next Friday. In the meantime, everybody, bring a stranger to the show on Monday. Parent teacher talk on Monday. And give the world the best gift you can possibly give. Have the best you get of your eternal life. Blessings. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice, and his wife, Jeannie, who present the internal Aramaic process of forgiveness. Michael and Jeannie are here every Monday through Friday on Earth Angels Radio. For more on Michael and Jeannie, please visit www.whyagain.com. That's www.whyagain.com.